I hope that you're all heading to sexgetsreal.com to let me know where you are. I've gotten some amazing responses so far, and I'm starting to see some cities that are standing out for a possible Sex Gets Real tour. So make sure you go to sexgetsreal.com, and it's right on the homepage. Let me know where you are, because I would love to come to a city near you and do a fun event where we can meet and hang out and laugh together. Also, be sure that you're on the newsletter. That's where I'll be announcing locations and events, and also follow along Sex Gets Real on Twitter. Here is my luscious, juicy chat with Andre Shakti. Bye. Hey everyone, Dawn Sarah here with Sex Gets Real. I don't normally start by reading my guest's bio, but this bio was just so awesome that that's what I'm going to do this week. I'm just going to read this bio and then say hello to the guest. So here's the bio. Andre Shakti is an educator, producer, activist, and professional slut devoted to normalizing alternative desires, destigmatizing sex workers and their clients, and not taking herself too seriously. She wrestles mediocre white men into submission and writes about sex work, queerness, and non-monogamy for Cosmopolitan, Harlot, MEL, and more. She can frequently be found marathoning Law & Order SVU under a chaotic pile of partners and pit bulls. And yes, she knows how problematic that show is. So welcome to Sex Gets Real, Andre.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I read your bio and I just thought there is so much in this short bio that's just so rich. I mean, like from professional slut to talking about destigmatizing sex work to wrestling mediocre white men. It's amazing.
I'm really good at writing copy, so I will like go ahead and give myself, like, I'll stroke my own cock for a minute and say that I'm also proud of that bio. And also I believe in kind of the like full transparency, like putting whatever you're most insecure about, like out in front of you before somebody else can use it as against you as a weapon. Yeah. And my Law & Order, my love for Law & Order SVU, especially in like the queer and like feminist circles, is definitely something that I have to like put out there right away, because it's so problematic. It's especially around like being sex worker negative and like conflating sex work with trafficking, that I'm like, I'm really sorry. Here's the biggest thing you're probably going to find, like, you know, take issue with my life. Here it is. I own it. The end.
Yeah. And I think it's just amazing that when you really look at, you know, like the porn and the wrestling and the sex work, it's like the thing that you want to get out in front of everybody is SVU.
It's true. My life is ass backwards in the best way possible sometimes.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I know. I was, were you at Sex Down South?
I was actually, yeah. I helped coordinate Sex Down South.
Cool.
I was
so,
on board. Yeah.
Yeah. So I saw you there. I didn't get a chance to like introduce myself, but I remember seeing you and just thinking like, holy shit, you're so awesome. And I had seen you on Crash Pad and love your work. And Sex Down South was so fucking amazing.
Wasn't it? It yeah. was like the best like inaugural conference I've ever been to. I mean, it was the first year and it was just fucking transformative. Just yeah. being in Atlanta at a sexuality conference, being at a sexuality conference that was mostly POC, yeah. Not only operated behind the scenes, but in terms of representation with the attendees and the presenters, I had just never been to another sexuality conference like it. And yeah. I am very proud of all the work that everybody put into it.
Yeah. The diversity of, you're right, not only the people running the conference, but the people attending and the vendors mm-hmm. was fantastic. And I would love to see so much more of that in our industry and the work that we do. And yeah, it was awesome. So
are you going to go back this year?
I'm probably not going to go back this year. So I'm hoping there's going to be a third year, because I'm actually, listeners know, I'm kind of like in the process of getting ready to move to Canada. And so, yeah, conferences this year are at a little bit of a low.
Yeah, that I feel you.
Yeah. Okay, so I was reading all of the things that you do, and I've seen a whole bunch of your articles, and you've had your hands in so many things. I mean, you call yourself a professional slut, and I've heard you talk about that you've done stripping and burlesque, and I've seen you in porn, and you do professional domination. And one of the things that I thought was just so fascinating, because I've never heard someone actually say that they do this, is your wrestling. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love, you've got that in your bio, wrestling mediocre white men into submission. And I heard you talk on Tristan's show, Sex Out Loud, about fetish wrestling. And so I would love, can you just tell us a little bit about like what that is and how you got into it?
Sure. So it's basically Feminist Fight Club. it is, when I was about, I want to say 20, I was living in Baltimore City. I'm from New Jersey originally. I went to school right outside of Baltimore and was there for 7 years. And that's where I got started. That's where like my queer identity took shape. That's where like my feminist identity started taking shape. And that's where I started doing sex work. And so I started stripping when I was 18, and that was like my first foray into the sex industry. And then I'd always been athletic. My mother, used to run triathlons and, just kind of like was the first person to like take me backpacking, was the first person to like take me rock climbing, was a really good influence. And so I kind of grew up always like dancing and running and going to the gym. And so when I was 20, I had been in the sex industry for about 2 years as a stripper and as a burlesque performer, and I answered a Craigslist ad looking for what they called catfighters. And so if you imagine, I'm sure you like use the term like umbrella in a lot of discussions that you have, but if you imagine, you know, fetish wrestling as like a big umbrella, and then there are all of these, like little nuanced facets of the industry underneath the umbrella. Mm-hmm. Cat fighting is one of those facets, and cat fighting is kind of defined by a fetish for seeing girls just like no holds bar, like going at each other.
Yeah.
Like no skill, like no martial arts training, no wrestling. They want to see the hair pulling. They want to see like the scratching and like the calling each other like a bitch. Mm-hmm. And all like this craziness. So I used to shoot these catfighting films in Baltimore when I was 20, and I would show up to this boxing gym in downtown Baltimore and get thrown in a boxing ring with a woman that I met 10 seconds before that and told to like just go.
Wow.
So basically like dog fighting with slightly more consent. So I loved this. Like, there were things about this that I loved. I've always been, like, a strong girl, so I liked being able to do something that I was good at, mm-hmm. Like, overpowered other people physically. I also was, like, coming out as queer at the time, and the whole, like, thing of, like, fighting and, like, wrestling, like, a woman that I am attracted to was also, like, it was dawning on me that that was, like, coming from a desire place on my end. So I thought it was hot, and I liked watching other girls fight. I thought that was hot. And then also, I just, like, I don't know. I just really love the adrenaline of it. It's like after, you know, whether you win or lose, I'm not extremely competitive actually. But I just really like the adrenaline, burst after, while I was like fighting and like after I was fighting. So the short story is that cat fighting is really dangerous because for a lot of reasons that are probably obvious. And I ended up getting a concussion about 2 years into doing this in a particularly bad fight. And I was like, you know what? I'm not doing this anymore. This is too dangerous. I don't want to break my, you know, 20-year-old body. And then I took about a year off. And then somebody, actually my friend Stefanos Tiziano, who I had known from the East Coast, was at an event, a Dark Odyssey event with me, and he said, I was maybe 23, and he said, you know, have you ever thought about doing porn? I work for kink.com. And I was like, yeah, I haven't thought about doing porn ever. And he's like, well, I know you wrestle, and there's this wrestling site on King.com called Ultimate Surrender, and it's girl on girl, and I think you would love it. And so I started wrestling, flying out to California to do Ultimate Surrender. And about a year after starting to do that, I started getting recognized by kind of fans who were interested in doing private sessions with me. And then I was like, okay, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. So I like started training in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I started, I was also operating a Dom at the time. So I started kind of gearing my Dom brand towards this niche market, towards what's called fetish wrestling or session wrestling. And the last thing I'll say about it is that it can look like a lot of different things. Some guys will come to me and they want a really competitive match. They really want their ass kicked. Some guys will come to me and they are more turned on by the power dynamics of it, which if you delve into it kind of comes from like a misogynist place where the whole reason they're finding the fact that I can kick their ass hot is because women aren't supposed to do that, right? So, like, there's a lot of, like, deep-seated, like, misogyny involved in desire, but my clients are really good guys. And so there can be, like, this semi-ass-kicking where we kind of acknowledge that I could kick their ass, but there's still, like, a playful element to it. And then all the way on the other side of the spectrum where they want something called fantasy wrestling, which is very non-athletic and very like campy and involves like role play. So I could be like a superhero and they're the super villain, or, you know, I'm the captain of the girls wrestling team in high school and they're auditioning for the girls wrestling team, you know, like all kinds of like when I'm basically just putting them in like exaggerated like chokes and scissor holds and they're being like, oh no, you've got me. So I do that. I probably see about, I would say 2 to 4 clients a week with that. I just came back from a session, ran back from a session to do the show actually. So.
Wow. That sounds like it could actually be a lot of fun. And it's something that's never actually occurred to me.
Yeah. What's really cool is that most of the women you see working in that niche of the sex industry, they started out, they had the opposite trajectory as I did. They started out as like martial artists, MMA fighters, professional wrestlers. And then at some point in their career, maybe when they're starting to worry that like they're aging out or, you know, they don't know how much longer they can do this. We're basically professional athletes. Mm-hmm. Like our bodies undergo so much wear and tear. Someone will mention to them, hey, like, did you know you can make like some extra money on the side, like wrestling dudes in like a bikini? And they're like, no, let me do that. And so yeah, it's kind of cool, that, you know, there are people in it that identify strongly as sex workers because they started out as sex workers. They started out wrestling like for, like money for the, in the sex industry. And then there are a lot of people who were like professional pro MMA or pro wrestlers. And someone kind of gave them the elbow at some point during their career. And were like, you know, you could do this on the side. So
is this something that you do strictly professionally and it doesn't play much of a role in like your personal relationships? Or is this something that you also enjoy in your personal intimate relationships?
Oh no, I totally enjoy it. I have this habit though. I date like, I don't really have a type. Like I date like, I call myself an equal opportunity dater. So I date cis men, I date cis women, I date trans men, I date trans women. But I usually end up like somehow, even though I'm attracted to muscles and I'm attracted to athleticism and I'm attracted to strength and all of these things, I end up dating people who are like half my size. Oh, I don't know how this happens. Like both my partners right now are like barely a buck 10. And I'm like, I try and wrestle them. It's just really not fair to them. But like, I actually, like I went to an event in April, International Miss Leather in San Jose. And like the person that I ended up connecting with was like, no big surprise, this like really hot femme, MMA fighter from down in Los Angeles. And I try and like get my balance when I can. And when I am doing girl fights, which usually is like around porn, that is definitely a turn on for me. Like 9 times out of 10, like I have to, you kind of have to like shut your brain off at a certain point, because if you're wrestling somebody that you're really attracted to, you're probably really distracted and you're probably not like, you're probably losing.
Yeah. Because you're like, God, this is really hot. Oh my God, her tits are on my back.
I go to like traditional Brazilian jiu-jitsu classes sometimes, where like, you know, you like wear the gi and like you walk into a room full of people who probably are not sex workers and may not be queer, and I have to like put my adult brain on and be like, okay, like you're not at work right now, you can't like Google someone's breasts while they're trying to like joint lock you, and you can't, you know, you can't like look like you're liking this too much, basically.
Stop smiling, stop smiling, stop smiling.
I know, it's really bad. So,
oh my God.
The struggle is real.
The struggle is so real. So I know you mentioned that you kind of folded this into your professional domination brand. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to know kind of what your experiences have been. Is when you're kind of doing your pro dom stuff, is it exclusively wrestling, or do you also do like humiliation and pain and sadomasochism and all that kind of stuff? Or kind of like, what's your brand or your version of pro dom work?
Yeah, so it's a really good question, because when folks start out in the sex industry, like, and people will email and text me and Facebook message me and all the things all the time being like, how can I get started in the sex industry? I'm interested in doing blank. Like, how do I move forward? And I basically tell them two different things. More if I have more time, but if I don't have time, I tell them two different things, which is number one, save half of everything that you make. Mm-hmm. And number two, find your niche market, find that market. You have to find like the perfect storm of what you already love doing and are good at, what you already love doing, what you're really good at doing, and then what people want to see you do, like what the demand is. And it takes like a few years. Like I tell people to hang in for over a year or two, because it takes a few years to figure that out. And if you start in a different area of the industry, like if you're moving from stripper to porn performer, or, you know, webcam model to dominatrix, you kind of have to start all over again. And, you know, where porn performers usually or can oftentimes have agents, there's no like, there's no counsel, like professional counsel. You know what I mean? For people operating in other areas of the sex industry. So the first few years, I've been doming for almost 4 years at this point. The first year and a half, 2 years, I pretty much just like ran the gamut. And I offered a wide variety of services, everything from corporal punishment to cock and ball torture to like elaborate role play and like pet play to, you know, just strap on to whatever the hell. And then as I was working more and like gaining more of a fan base, and people started telling me, you know, what they really liked watching me do, and like, you know, what they really wanted me to do, what they wanted to hire me for. And, I also just really, my two favorite things in the whole world in terms of sex work are wrestling and strap-on fucking, and fisting. Those are the three. So I was like, fuck it. Like people want to see me do the things that I already love doing and the things that I'm already the best at. And so about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I started gearing most of my marketing towards strap-on domination and fetish wrestling. And so most of my clients come to me for one of those two things, if not both. And other things will sneak their way in there, you know, like maybe part of the strap on, you know, maybe they're in bondage while, you know, while they're receiving like strap on, play, or maybe, you know, there's a role play scenario that involves like things like humiliation or degradation around why they're getting pegged or why I'm kicking their ass in the wrestling mat. So lots of things find their way in, but those are like my big, I don't know, sellers, I guess.
At. So. Your specialties.
Exactly.
So what makes for a really good client in your opinion? Because I think that, you know, a lot of people I think, abuse sex workers and the way they approach them and expect things from them, and also just don't know how to have these conversations because it's not something we ever talk about in our culture or teach people how to do. Yeah. So, like, for you, what makes someone the kind of client that you think, oh, I'd really like to work with you?
Oh, I love, you know, no one's ever asked me that question before. I love that question so much.
Yay.
So, number one, like, something that I have written pretty extensively about publicly and, like, just, like, on my website is the emotional labor that's inherent in doing sex work. So, you know, the common argument is, like, oh, well, like, sex workers get paid so much money. You know, I'm paying $200 or $300 or $400 an hour to see a sex worker. You know, why is that much money? And I'm like, well, it's that much money because, number one, we don't have health insurance. So that's covering, you know, that's covering the in case we get injured. As I mentioned before, we're sexual athletes. If we hurt our bodies or we fall ill, we can't work. We don't have unemployment. So that's number one. Number two is that it doesn't actually just encompass the 1 hour that we are in each other's company. It actually encompasses all of the administrative work around and emotional work around negotiating and setting up and confirming that appointment with you. Which is, like, you know, from somebody, from us having to put up ads, you know, on our own behalfs and pay for advertising, field all of the responses that we get from our ads, which maybe I would say only 60% out of 100% of folks who email me actually result in paid work. The rest are what we affectionately call wankers. Who just want to message you for, like, their own fantasy fulfillment and don't actually intend on ever paying you money. And so, you know, it's like we're being paid to be our own agent, you know, our own secretary, our own personal assistants, in addition to actually, like, standing in front of you and doing the work for the hour. So clients, I don't have very many horror stories. I really have, like, wonderful clients, by far and large. But the biggest pitfall they fall into is not understanding how much emotional labor goes into booking a session and taking advantage of that, whether consciously or unconsciously, prior to the session. What I would like to hear from you if you want to book with me is one email giving me, you know, your name, what you want to book me for, where you're located and when you're available, and then any experience you have in that thing. So if it's wrestling, for example, I always want to know from people, you know, have you ever wrestled before? Do you have any martial arts training? Like, are you physically fit? How often do you work out? That kind of thing. What I will sometimes get are men who just send me, like, 7-paragraph long dictations of, like, their deepest, darkest fantasy, or men that send me a list of questions to answer before we get together, that are not logistical in nature, that are like, why did you want to become a wrestler? Or, like, what about it turns you on? And it's so obvious. Like, we know what you're doing. Like, we know that you're sitting there behind your computer screen, like, jerking off to these answers, you know, should they come back to you, which they won't, unless you offer me money to answer them. But yeah, it's people not understanding, because our society still doesn't acknowledge, largely acknowledge sex work as legitimate labor. There is this, like, prevalent idea in people's heads that this is, like, this fun thing we do as, like, a hobby. Like, we're all just, like, sitting around, like, having, like, slumber parties and rolling around in, like, beds of money and, like, picking up the phone or the computer whenever we feel like it. But it's actually our livelihoods, and our time is very precious, and our time deserves to be rewarded. So people who are courteous and respectful, who don't try and utilize my time or feel entitled to my time for free, either prior to a session or after a session, and folks who shower are also really great. I always tell my clients, like, please shower before you come see me. If we're doing strap-on play, please, like, clean out ahead of time, which means, like, you know, use some enemas and be conscious of, like, what the rear part of your body is doing in the time prior to us getting it together. And I really don't have too much issue with that. It really is mostly just people feeling entitled to my time before we get together in a way that is an abuse of power. That is an abuse of it's just an abuse of power. I mean, you wouldn't if you have a doctor's appointment tomorrow, you wouldn't be trying to call the doctor's office demanding to get the doctor's personal number, personal email address, so you can send them all these questions ahead of time and have them answer all of your questions and all of your concerns and all of your, inquiries before you guys get together without paying them something for their time and their expertise. And sex work honestly should be treated the same way. So again, I'm very fortunate, and also have had a few people message me to say, hey, listen, I live on the other side of the country and I can't ever session with you, but I'm really curious about A, B, and C, and I'm totally willing to, send you some cash if you have time to answer some questions for me. And then I'm like, fuck yes, I have time to answer some questions for you. Thank you for respecting my work,
Mm-hmm. That's really awesome. And I think that's such an important part of all forms of sex work, from doing pro dom work and wrestling to strippers and respecting their time and that you paid for one song and not expecting two and, all that kind of stuff. But I feel like the emotional labor part and the entitlement is a piece that just gets so overlooked in all of these very heated discussions that come up around sex work that always tend to be so black and white and trafficked versus empowered, and it leaves out a lot of the nuance. And I think the nuance is so critical to all of us being able to do better when it comes to honoring sex work as legitimate labor and also being better consumers, because I think the more that we can be conscious consumers, then the more we're going to be able to have access to these things that we really want.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And there, again, like you mentioned before, I really love, I also write a lot about my clients, and I've written articles where I've interviewed my clients and written articles about how clients are demonized, sometimes even worse than sex workers themselves, in certain scenarios. And so, I feel like, and like you said before, there is no education, just as there is no education out there, in the world for sex workers trying to build their own business, because actually, depending on what kind of sex work you're talking about, advising someone on how to be a sex worker could land you in jail. There's a law in California, for example. It was originally designed for pimps of prostitutes, and it basically stipulates that if you advise somebody on how to be a prostitute, that you can actually you can be arrested and you can be charged with a greater charge. I think it's a felony one, because it was designed to stop the pimps from pimping out girls. But really, if somebody emails me and is how do I get started as a high-end escort, I have to be you should call me, because I can't leave a paper trail, because I could actually get arrested. So there are no resources like that. There are no resources for clients on how to be an ethical client. There are no resources out there that are readily available and publicly promoted on how to ethically consume pornography. There's nothing. So I give clients a lot of leeway. I give them a lot of grace, which I know a lot of sex workers, rightfully so, don't have the patience for a lot of the work that goes into educating folks on how to be more ethical and more respectful. But I just think it's really important. And I know that it's not something that, most people would ever think to try and find,
Yeah. One of the things that I'm constantly talking about on the show is the importance of paying for your porn. And how, for some reason, we've gotten to this place where we feel like we're owed free porn just because we want it. And, you know, with all the tube sites and aggregator sites and all this kind of stuff, you know, it's kind of become this thing where, well, of course I'm going to pay for my meal when I go out. And of course I'm going to pay for my gas in my car, but why would I ever pay for porn? And I think it comes back to this just lack of education around like sex work being legitimate labor. And I know that you have worked with Crashpad and a couple of other companies. And I'd just love to know, from your perspective, what do you wish more people knew about porn and consuming it? And kind of what's your experience been in creating porn?
I think something that the average porn consumer, like the biggest like kind of misconception the average porn consumer has, is that they can tell what an ethical porn is just by watching it. I hear a lot of people say, oh, you know, like I can't watch porn because I tried watching it and there was a scene where this girl was obviously not enjoying it and obviously being coerced into what was happening, and it made me really uncomfortable. Or, you know, I watched this thing and this man was like being beat on by this other man, and he was like getting ready to cry, and it was like so obvious that he didn't want to be there, and so I couldn't watch it. And I'm like, okay, well, let's back this up for a second. like, tell me again why you think that is obvious. And let's take the man crying, for example. And they're like, oh, well, like, tears equals bad. And I'm like, okay, like, can you unpack that a little more for me? Like, what in your experience equates tears with always being bad? And they're like, you know, well, tears are associated with sadness. And I'm like, yes, that's true. Tears are also complex and are associated with joy. They're associated with cathartic release. They are also associated with sadness. They can be associated with adrenaline. They can be associated with wind getting in your eyes and your eyes stinging and tears coming out of them. So I try, there's kind of this prevalent assumption that folks are unconsciously trying to police other people's bodies and other people's like sexual reactions based on their own or what they believe the standard to be, and they don't realize consciously usually that that's what they're doing when they're watching porn. But when we look at something and we say, well, she doesn't look wet enough like while she's getting fucked, so she's obviously not turned on, or she's, you know, telling him to stop and she sounds really genuine, so obviously like she must be, you know, she must be really in crisis. And when we stop trying to like convince ourselves that we know what every single other person in the world's bodies are like and what their reactions are and what their desires are, and we just let ourselves watch something for what it is, which is first and foremost a fantasy performance. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't like, you know, Julia Roberts played a hooker in Pretty Woman, and when she got off set at the end of the day, people didn't have trouble understanding that Julia Roberts is not a hooker in real life.
Right.
That's the thing that people, you know, struggle with. But there's this disconnect that happens with pornography where we see what's happening on in front of us and we believe that it's really happening the way that it looks, when in reality it is a very carefully staged and constructed scenario. That being said, it's also a complex industry, and there are issues of non-consent that are in the industry, just as there are issues of non-consent floating around mainstream Hollywood, just as there are issues of non-consent floating around any kind of labor, you know, where there are power dynamics, because labor is, you know, to say labor is inherently like, you know, run by a careful designation of power. Mm-hmm. And delineation of power is what I wanted to say. And so, yeah, it's really hard. And again, I don't belabor this too much. I don't try and make people feel like assholes for thinking this way, because this is how our society raised us. You know, they raised us to look at porn as objectifying and harmful and anti-feminist and non-consensual. And it can be all of those things, and it can also be really empowering and consensual and healthy and you know, legit labor. So again, for some reason, people only like stop thinking complexly when it comes to porn, like of any work industry, any labor industry, like we can see each industry as being complex, but we all of a sudden hit this like mental roadblock when it involves sex in any way. Yeah. So I just caution people to not assume that you know just by viewing something that you assume that you know what's going on. And if you were interested in seeking out ethical porn, Violet Blue, I always refer to her website. Her website is tinynibbles.com, but she has a whole page dedicated to a list of ethically produced pornography for people of all genders. Mm-hmm. It's skewed towards women, women who are looking for porn. There's a tab called Literate Smut, I believe.
I will have a link on sexgetsreal.com. Yeah,
okay. We'll find it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I also just want to throw out one more quick thing about the porn industry is that the porn industry is the only industry in the world where women consistently get paid more than men. It is the only labor industry in the world, including mainstream Hollywood. So I just want to like toss that out there that it's very interesting how often politicians and right wing fanatics try and demonize porn and pull it into the public spotlight in a demonizing or criminalizing way, and it's the only industry where women are paid more than men are. So just gonna leave that out there. Drop my
just let people marinate on that little tidbit. Okay, so. Speaking of porn, one of the scenes that I saw of you on Crash Pad was with Tina Horn, and there was fisting that was happening. And I know that's something that you teach. You actually teach a class on fisting, and or probably more than one. And it's something that you really love talking about. And I've talked about it a couple of times, including my own experiences with it. And it always tends to send a handful of listeners into like major squick mode. And I get tweets like, "Oh, I had to turn it off. I heard the word fisting." And like, I would love to just hear from you. Like, what about fisting do you love? Like, what's the thing that you just wish more people knew about fisting?
Sure. So the thing that turns, and of course, everybody is turned on. Everyone who's into fisting is turned on by it for a variety of different reasons, right? But the reason that I primarily, like what drew me into fisting and what I hear often from other people in talking about why they love it is for people who were born without penises attached to their bodies, the idea of putting an entire part of your own body into someone else is so alien. And because it is so alien, it is so easy to fantasize about and fetishize and eroticize because it's we don't take it for granted because we don't have penises attached to our bodies. We don't have the opportunity, opportunity that society tells us is an opportunity to just like put something in somebody else in that way. And so the first time that I was introduced to fisting as a fisting top, that struck me more than anything. There was like a moment where my hand went into this person and I just like was completely overwhelmed by the fact I couldn't wrap my head around the fact that like my hand was inside their body. Like my whole hand was inside their body. And I was like, this is so fucking hot. This is so hot because I'd never experienced a like experience before. I'd never been in a position like that. I put one or two fingers inside somebody, but there's just my whole limb, a whole part of my limb was in there. So I couldn't get over that. And I just think that is so hot. And I'm also, really into strap-on play. And I really like putting things that are not, that are attached to my body, but, not necessarily part of my body in people very much as well. But there is just something about being able to feel inside of someone's body and like them letting you do that. That is really powerful and really erotic. And so that, like, above everything else for me is, like, the reason, like, why people should try fisting, particularly if they don't have penises. It just, again, like, from the top, it's so great. And there are a million reasons why fisting is great, but that is the first thing I always think of.
Do you experience fisting different when you're fisting a pussy versus fisting an ass?
Oh, yeah. a pussy is definitely self-lubricating. while I strongly encourage the copious use of lubricant, particularly silicone lubricant, in doing any kind of fisting. The vagina can, you know, it was designed for childbirth, so it can accommodate a lot. And again, people have varying, you know, varying levels of openness, depending on their bodies and, you know, what medications they're on and how old they are and if they've had kids or haven't had kids, etc. But generally speaking, like, the vagina is an amazing thing and can accommodate things of large sizes and stretch out and self-lubricates and, you know, cleanses itself, and it's beautiful. And so putting something into a vagina is oftentimes less risky, so to speak. And I don't say risky in terms of, like, STDs or anything, but, like, the skin in the anus is very thin. Mm-hmm. And so, because it's so thin and because the anus is not self-lubricating, there is the possibility when extreme pressure is going into the ass that there could be tears if you're not using enough lube, going really slow, doing lots of foreplay, you know, one finger at a time, like, building up very gradually. There's a little bit less of a risk of injury, to the vaginal canal when you're fisting, just because of, you know, what it's capable of doing. And also, again, it is self-lubricating. So there definitely is a difference. Also, your hand can literally just keep going down someone's ass. Like,
and there's my elbow.
Yeah, right? Like, eventually, like, I have these, like, they're, like, calf birthing nitrile gloves that come up to the elbows. People also call them, like, opera glove, like, mm-hmm. nitrile gloves. And those are my fisting gloves because, for clients, for work, because, you know, the vagina ends with the cervix. Like, there's a cap on the vagina, and you're going to hit it eventually. Like, you know, no matter how roomy it is in there or tight it is, there's a cap. And with the ass, you can just keep on going. So, you can often do, like, deeper fisting and you know, a few – you can get a lot deeper into somebody's ass than you can into somebody's vaginal canal.
Do you have a preference for one or the other?
I mean, most of my partners, I've been very fortunate where I'm poly, so I date usually about two or three people at the same time, and I'm usually always dating someone who can get fisted, which is great, because I love fisting people. And my partners tend to be assigned female birth, so I'm usually fisting vaginal canals, vaginas, and so I feel like I have more competency around fisting vagina just because I do it all the time. Mm-hmm. And with my clients, it's a little rarer. A lot of times clients will come in saying, I want you to fist my ass and put, as you know, the biggest toys you can in my ass and like tear me apart. And then we get in there and, like, 9 times out of 10, I can barely get a butt plug in there, you know? Like,
yeah.
So I end up fisting vaginas way more often. And so, yeah, I feel like I just could probably do it in my sleep at this point. Always down.
Yeah. Yeah, I know so my former co-host Dylan and I would talk about fisting, and there's definitely this, like, intensity that not only comes with the experience, but I think also just when you hear fisting, kind of just your initial reaction, if you're not familiar with it, is like, holy shit, you know? And for people who are curious, do you have any just kind of like 101 tips if someone's like, well, maybe I kind of want to try that?
Yeah, totally. So I always recommend, normally I am somebody who, who, in terms of buying sex toys, I steer them towards, you know, like ethical, like feminist run stores and businesses. I steer them towards toys that are like higher caliber, that are higher quality materials, that can be sanitized, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of like experimentation, which always and should always prelude fisting, I actually oftentimes recommend people buy cheap toys because, as long as you throw a condom on them, honestly, if you're just using them to experiment with, to figure out if, you know, that particular toy is something that you might like or might not like, that way you're not breaking the bank doing so. And what I recommend to people on 101 levels for fisting is, number one, you want to practice at home, and whether that means by yourself or with a partner or partners is totally up to you. But the way that you kind of work up to the girth of a fist is by basically fucking yourself with toys of increasing size, masturbating like by yourself with toys of increasing size. And if I were someone just getting into it, I would go to a cheapo sex toy store and I would buy like 3 cheapo dildos that are a variety of sizes, you know, working up in length and girth. And I would bring them home and throw condoms on them and go to town and see how much information you can gather about your body before actually trying to put a hand in it. So for example, some people, you know, let's talk about people who have vaginas. Some folks with vaginas, they are really tight until they put a vibrator on their clit, and then all of a sudden their vagina opens up and is like, oh, you know. And then some people, you put a vibrator on their clit and their vagina like clamps down, you know, because they're like, oh my God, I'm going to come like right away, and their vagina like clamps down. Some people are more open before they've had an orgasm. Some people need to have an orgasm or two before, assuming they're multi-orgasmic, before they can get something of a larger girth inside of them. It actually, the more they come, like the more it relaxes the muscles. So like everybody's different, and you're not really going to know that stuff about your body until you do the work and you figure it out. So experimentation ahead of time, either by yourself or with a partner, mutual masturbation, them fucking you with the toys that you bought, etc. And also, it's not something to try on like a quickie. Like,
right.
Like if you have like, you know, if you're like, hey babe, like I have an hour lunch break, like let's go home real fast and meet at the house and do that new fisting thing. Like that is not a thing that you should do. I advocate strongly that the first few times you try fisting that you and your partner are relatively sober. You are not blitzed out of your minds on whatever, you know, booze, weed, whatever your drug of choice is, that you leave ample time so neither one of you are feeling rushed. And also if it ends up not working out, you guys have enough time to then like connect in the way that you normally connect, that you're already comfortable fucking, to fuck in the way that you want to fuck, and then like, you know, kind of end that experience on a positive note. And also to prepare for mess. There's going to be a lot of mess because sex is really messy and you should be using a lot of lube.
Yeah.
And if you're not, if you think you're using enough lube, awesome, add some more. You know, and when people get fisted, especially vaginas, you know, there can be a lot of like, there's a lot of cum, there's a lot of body fluids. If asses get fisted, even if they did clean out ahead of time, sometimes there can be some residue, you know, in the ass, which is like totally fine, but always recommending the purchasing of lots of dark colored towels and just telling people to just expect mess, you know, lots of time. Please do it relatively sober, buy a bunch of cheap toys and practice ahead of time and expect a lot of mess, and you will be great. You will go forth into the world fisting.
Yeah. And I love your advice so much of kind of getting to know your body, because for me, I'm one of those people where I have to have had a couple of orgasms before my muscles have relaxed. It takes me a while in just everyday life to relax. And so my pussy's the same way in that I need to have a couple of orgasms before my pussy's just kind of like all right, now I'm really open for business. And then we can start playing with that. Whereas I have a friend who was like, no, once I have the orgasm, I'm on shutdown. And so if we're going to do the fisting, it's got to, that like the orgasm has to happen after the fisting. Otherwise, nothing's going in.
And also keep in mind, just as penis sizes on people who have penises vary tremendously, hand sizes also vary tremendously, especially if we're talking about women who are dating cisgender men mm-hmm. who tend to have much broader hands than, you know, women or, you know, some trans folks. You know, some people, like, you might be trying to get fisted by your partner and it's not working out, and you're like, oh my god, like, my hole is failing me. But some people just have really fucking huge hands that you don't want in your body, or that, like, you know, because, you know, maybe, like, they have, like, big, you know, like, broad man hands, like, mechanic hands, and, like, the nails are ragged, and the hands are calloused, and you look at them, and you're like, oh, no, this is not for me. Or just the size in general is too large. So it's kind of like a glass slipper situation, mm-hmm. like a Cinderella glass slipper situation in a way, because just as, you know, holes can vary in what they can accommodate, what size item inside of them they can accommodate, hands also vary in size and also, like, how collapsible they are, which can greatly affect whether or not they can fist somebody. So don't get discouraged if your partner tries fisting you with their giant hands and you're like, oh my god, my body is failing me, this is my fault. It is not your fault. Like, mm-hmm. it is just not an ideal fit. That's not an ideal fit, and it doesn't mean that you'll never get fisted or you'll never be able to be fisted. But that whole hand situation just may not be super compatible for that, you know? And that's okay.
Yeah, my ex-girlfriend had ginormous, meaty hands that were not really collapsible. And we tried fisting once, and she got about 3 fingers in, and I was like, that's as far as we're going. You know? And then I've had other partners, like my current partner, his hands just fit really well in me. And so, yeah, I think, like, for me, the thing about fisting is you can want to explore fisting, but then also make sure you're still keeping it fun and that it's not about, like, oh, we failed. It's like, well, look how far we got. Cool.
Yeah. Like, learn to celebrate the milestones, like the multiple milestones that could be found in experimentation with fisting, not just the fist. The same way that we teach people to have a less goal-oriented approach to sex in general, which is, like, kind of universally understood as, like, orgasm is not, like, the end-all be-all, like, you know, it should not be the goal of the sexual interaction, right? The same thing is true when you go into any kind of sexual experimentation situation where you and your partner have a goal at the end of it. It's okay to have goals as long as you're really, like, kind to yourself and you find joy in whatever you're doing and you have the ability to laugh at yourself and also to give yourself a pat on the back for any kind of, like, evolutions or new experiences or new sensations or new knowledge acquired about your body, or, you know, maybe you didn't get a fist inside but you worked up to the second largest dildo for the first time, you know, or et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So just learning to, again, be kind to ourselves, like, reminding ourselves that sex is really funny and it's, like, okay to laugh, you know? In fact, it's great. Laughing is one of the most necessary tools that I encourage people to utilize during sex. And celebrating the little things, you know, celebrating the milestones.
Yeah. I love that advice. And I, like, just looked at the clock and I was like, oh shit, we're at the end of our time. And I want to, like, talk to you about, like, non-monogamy and poly and consent and sex work. And, like, oh my gosh, there's so many things. So I am just going to declare that I would love to have you back on the show at some point in the near future.
I would love to come back and talk about all the things that I'm sure we could waste hours and hours and hours chatting about.
Yes, absolutely. So I would love for you to tell our listeners where they can find you and how they can stay in touch.
Sure. So the best way to reach me is either actually on Facebook. I'm one of the few hoes that still successfully utilizes Facebook. You can find me as Andre Shakti on Facebook. I'm also at Andre Shakti, and that's AndreShakti on Twitter. And my website, which is very pretty to look at but very infrequently updated, is AndreShaktiXXX.com.
I totally agree with you on your website. It's gorgeous. Those pictures of you are stunning on just like every page.
I got screwed over by my old marketing company, so I literally have to hire hackers to like hack into my like my hosting domain and like so that I can make structural changes to the website, which is why it's just been like sitting there. But yes, it's very nice to look at if you want to go look at it.
Well, I will have all of your links on sexgetsreal.com so people can easily find you. And I just want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing all your amazing stories and advice and thoughts, because this was just delightful.
Yeah, you're wonderful to talk to. Thank you so much for having me. And until part two.
Yes, exactly. So thank you so much to all of our listeners for listening. Be sure to go to sexgetsreal.com if you have stories, comments, or any questions that you'd like us to answer down the road. Of course, you can follow Sex Gets Real on both Twitter and Facebook. So hop over there so you can see all the other things that I'm up to. Thank you so much. I will talk to you next week. This is Dawn Sarah. Bye.